Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Golf Talk Live. I'm your host, Ted Odorico, and tonight we're going to have a great show, as we always do, with another great round of Coach's Corner. I got my panel ready to go here, but just very quickly before I bring them on, let me remind everybody, of course, that we're live right now from 6 to 8 p.m. Central Standard Time, and that's 7 to 9 for you on the East Coast. You can tune in if you want at blogtalkradio.com. And you can do one of two things. You can either just add the link on blogtalkradio.com/golftalklive, or you can just type in Golf Talk Live up in the search key at the top of that page. And don't forget also, if you want to get updates on the show right from that page, what you can do is there's a little follow key. You can just click on follow, and you'll automatically get messages sent to your inbox letting you know of each and every episode coming up. So great way to follow the program, or certainly one of the ways to follow it. Don't forget, you can also call in and speak with either myself or any of the guests or panel on Coach's Corner. You can do so by calling area code 646-716-4667, or you can also email either questions or comments to me personally at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. And other ways that you can follow on social media, you can follow me on Facebook. You can follow the show on Facebook at facebook.com/golftalkliveblog. And you can also follow me on Twitter at TedandBuckCEO. Don't forget also to check out the Golf Talk Live website at www.golftalkliveblog.com. And thank you very much for tuning in. And, of course, I'm going to bring out the panel for this week's Coach's Corner. First up here is Mr. Gary Occhino, who is one of our, I think he's been on here a couple times now on the panel. He's a PGA teacher professional and also author of Play Golf Like the Pros. And you can follow Gary at his website at GaryOcchinoGolf.com, and that's OCCHINOGolf.com. Also alongside him is Michael Wheeler, PGA Director of Instruction at the Bellwood Golf and Country Club up in Pennsylvania. And we're happy to have him join us. And you can also check out his club at BellwoodGolf.com, and that's BelleWoodGolf.com. And rounding up the panel, of course, is another favorite, been back on the show a number of times, Brad Redding, PGA Master Teacher Professional and Director of Instruction at the Members Club at Grand Dunes in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And he's also the owner and operator of Brad Redding Golf. And you can find all you need to know about him at bradreddinggolf.com. And that's Redding, R-E-D-D-I-N-G, golf.com. Gentlemen, welcome to Golf Talk Live, and welcome to Coach's Corner.
Thanks, Ted.
Thank you.
I hope I got everything right and got it all out there, and if not, we'll correct it as we go along. And I just want to say on air, as I did off air, guys, thank you very much. I realize tomorrow being July 4th, of course, is a big holiday here in the United States, and always happy to celebrate any holiday that I'm when I'm down here. But I know it's a big day, and I appreciate you guys coming on the night before, or the eve before, if you will, and spending some time with my audience. So thank you very much, guys, for doing that.
No problem.
No problem.
Okay. As we all know, of course, on Coach's Corner every week is your opportunity to email the program and pick the brains of some of the best coaches and teaching pros in the business, like we have here tonight. And, of course, I try to have a different panel every week, and we cover a new topic, plus try to help some of you weekend warriors out there. And as I was just telling the guys off air, in the next few weeks to come, I'm going to be doing something a little bit different with the Coach's Corner group, and what I'm going to be doing is actually doing a series, and it's called Plan for Success. And I talked about it a little bit last week. I'm not getting into too much tonight, but just a little snippet, if you will. We're going to be covering several areas of golf that I feel that are important to truly be a successful player, and that's not just somebody on the tour. That's just for anybody that wants to be a better golfer. And then some of the key areas are, of course, fitness. So we're going to get some of the top guys in fitness on the program. Nutrition, what goes into your body is going to help fuel you, and make you a better player. We're also going to talk more about the equipment and how to be properly fitted and so forth on here. And, of course, instruction. That's what we're all about here is instruction. And, of course, practice. Practice, practice, practice. We're going to get that into your head once and for all. And, of course, we're going to talk about the mental side, using your noggin, finding your way around the course. So, and then we're going to put it all together on the last episode. But I'll give you more details when time comes on for those of you listening to the program tonight. But that's what we're going to be doing a little bit differently. And each topic we're going to cover an entire program too. So make sure you stay tuned for more details on that as it comes up. Okay, guys, I got a really interesting, and I picked this for the topic tonight to start us off. Jim from San Diego, California wrote in, guys, he says, I want to take my game up a notch. And Jim writes here, he says, I'm a 4 handicap. He says, I've kept it around that number for a few years now. He says, I've tried to get it lower, but doesn't seem to be able to budge his handicap at all. He says he went from a 20 down to a 10, now down to a 4, but seems to have sort of leveled off. And his goal, which we want to help him with here tonight if we can, is to become a scratch golfer. So his question, of course, is very simple. Do you have any suggestions on what I can do to accomplish that? So I'm going to start off, if that's okay, I'm going to start off with Gary, and then we'll go to Michael, and then we'll go to Brad. We'll let you round out the panel tonight on this topic. But essentially, this is a problem, I think, that a lot of players have. It's a little easier to go from 20, I think, down to a low handicap. But once you sort of get there, a lot of golfers sort of peter off and sort of level off at that, as Jim talks about here. So, Gary, what are some things that maybe we can do to help Jim?
Well, this is a very general situation without having a lot of details. But I would
sure.
break down Jim's game the best we could. So let's look at the long game first. I think it would be almost a requirement at this point to know ball flight laws and understand what trends he has and how to work with what we're labeling as the modern ball flight laws. I would look at everything from bounce on the ledges, things like that, for short game. I'd wonder how. I think it's important to keep stats at this point. I like students to keep detailed stats, whether it's through an app or through their own homemade way or planning with a coach, and spending about once a month reviewing them. I don't think you should look at your stats more than about once a month. Otherwise, you become a little too dominated by them. But really looking at the stats
right.
and figuring out what is in line with, let's call it scratch averages or tour-type stats and what isn't. So, for example, you may look at something like putting and see that, you're a couple putts higher than maybe where a typical scratch golfer or a tour pro is. And
right.
then you break that down further. You might need to work on your green reading. As an example, not your scope of your green reading or maybe how you respond after things like a bogey or double bogey, things like that. I think you have to really look at more advanced analysis. So those would be a few of things I would, without knowing our, was it Jim was the question?
Sure.
Knowing Jim, those are some things I would probably recommend, before having a conversation with him.
Yeah, and that's some great points. I think that once you get to a certain level, certainly accomplishment, you need to start looking, I wouldn't say through a magnifying glass, but you need to be a little bit more critical of some of the things you're doing. Keeping stats as an example and checking those out, I think, are great. And obviously, sort of breaking down your game into different components, the long game and putting and sort of separating those and studying that and doing it that way. Michael, if you had some suggestions, and again, I understand that these are fairly generic questions, but if you had some suggestions, anything different than you would add that Gary has touched on?
Yeah, I mean, I think Gary hit a lot of the points. I think the biggest thing when you get to that level, mental game, and short game really take into effect. I mean, you can look at a lot of the, good amateurs, and then you look at good touring professionals. They all, they all can hit the ball pretty decent. I'm assuming if you went down from 20 to 10 and 10 to 5, a lot of that time I'm assuming will probably been work on the long game with his full swing, where, I think it's, focus a lot on the short game and that way if you miss a green, if you're missing, 6-7 greens around, continue to work on your long game, but, you know, work on that short game so you have the confidence to turn around. I think the biggest, to kind of touch on stats, I'm a big proponent of stats as well. I try to play in a lot of tournaments like we talked about off air, but I keep stats from every event that I play, even non-competitive round of golf that I play. I keep my stats. I write them down. Not only do I keep my putts, but I keep the how far each putt is, so I can track the one of the most important stats that I use is strokes gained putting, and read a great book about it called Every Shot Counts. And I don't know if you guys have read it, but it's a great book about how to go from that go from a five down even lower. Just understanding if your putts are high. Maybe because, like Jerry said, maybe because green reading and all that, but it may also be because you're not hitting it close enough. You may have 20 footers all the time when if you work on your short game 100 yards and in, 100, maybe even branch out to 120 and in for your wedges, depending on how far he hits it, you could probably drop quite a few shots just by doing that as well.
Right. And that's as well as some great points. Brad, let's kind of look at this from a little bit different perspective. What are some of the reasons, as Jim had indicated here in his email, and I'm not saying it's easy, obviously everybody would be doing it, but I think it is an easier transition going from, say, a 20 or 25 handicap down to a lower number like 4 or 5. Why do so many people have a difficult time once they reach that sort of low handicap of, 3, 4, or 5, to be able to go that? Why is the transition so much harder from that point than it is from, say, a higher number down to the low number?
Well, I mean, in going from a 20 handicapper down to a lower handicapper, it's mainly ball striking. I mean, they become better ball strikers, which is pretty easy for people to obtain. To actually get better at ball striking. I mean, somebody told me the other day, I said, Brad, I've heard the short game is the most important part of the golf game. I said, well, you know what, if you top it 15 times down the fairway and on the 16th shot you're on the green and one putt, I don't care how good a putter you are, you suck at ball striking. So, I try to get people to be better ball strikers. It's easy to do that, I think. Now, when they get down to that lower handicap and they want to really, get that to a zero, I think what you got to do is you got to do more assessing of where the weakness is in your game. What I call a short game test, and I base it on handicap as far as I get in the handicap for each part of the short game, putting, chipping, pitching, and I give them a handicap, and I say, look, if you're a 15 handicap at putting and a 4 handicap at chipping, we've got to get that putting obviously better, and they don't know that, though. They don't know that they're that part of the game actually suffers. So assessing their golf game in terms of all parts is the way to take it from where they are to a lower number, because a lot of people don't even know that, okay, well, I feel like I'm a pretty good putter. I say, well, you might be a pretty good putter, but, you're chipping it, 15 feet, close to the pin, so your chipping is suffering. You maybe make a few of those putts, every once in a while, make those 15-footers, but your chipping is actually suffering, and so they don't understand that. And I think assessments is the key to them improving in terms of moving the handicap from 4 to 0.
Yeah, I agree. And some great points, guys. And I think Gary started us off here and hit it right on the head. And that's so true. I think Brad, what you just was sort of finishing there saying as well. I think breaking down and doing an assessment on different components of the game, I think, is very good because, like as you said, you might be a 15, might be a 15 handicap in your putting, but you could be a 4 in chipping, or vice versa. So it's good to isolate those areas. Let me very quickly before we continue on, guys. I got myself in a talking tangent earlier, and I forgot to mention something to the listeners here. But later in the program, of course, I'm going to be interviewing Mr. Stephen Yellen. Who is the author of The Fluid Motion Factor, A Revolutionary Understanding of Golf. And he, of course, works with the Ledbetter Academy, and he's going to be joining us a little bit later in the broadcast. So I apologize. I forgot to mention that off the top. But guys, I think that one of the things that as Gary was saying, looking at the stats, sort of understanding things a little bit better, what numbers are important and sort of, you know, getting a better understanding from that end. Because I think once you've gone to that level and you get down to, you know, a 3 or 4 or 5 handicap, to get to that next, you know, level, if you will, down to a 0, you've obviously become an accomplished ball striker, so you know that that's in the bag. It doesn't mean, as Gary indicated, doesn't mean you don't continue to still work on it, but you probably are not going to get any you know, difference there. So you're going to have to start looking at other areas of the game, and the only way to do that is to really start looking at the numbers a little bit harder. So great way to answer that, guys. Thank you. Jim, I hope that helps, and if you have any other questions, you can certainly email me, and we'll try and do some follow-ups if we didn't answer anything. Interesting enough, two of you mentioned stats, and our next question is from Sandro, and that's R-O, not Sandra. So this is a guy, probably Italian, I would guess, from Alberta, Canada. And he mentioned stats. This is what he has to say, and we'll try and see if we can make some clarification. He says, I often read in most of the golf mags and or here on TV about greens and regulations, scoring average, scoring range, average number of putts, et cetera. He says, it seems that the golfer today is bombarded with a lot of stats. He says, I, for one, think some of the stuff I'm reading might be good for pros, but his question is, does knowing all of these numbers, two questions actually, knowing all of these numbers really matter to the average high handicapper, and do you teachers or coaches look at these numbers when working with students? Michael, I'm going to start with you this time. Let's tackle the first question. Now, he's obviously referring to more high handicappers. I certainly believe in stats. I think it's important. When you're dealing with some of your students, are stats important, or does it depend on the level of play?
I think it's kind of both, but I definitely think stats are important. You know, I mean, if you're talking about a high handicapper, I guess we're talking about how high that goes. If we're talking about a 36 handicapper like Brad, so let's just work on, you know, your ball striking, because if you're a 36 handicapper, I highly doubt you're knocking around 20 times on the green and getting there in two.
Right.
So, but once you get to, you know, a certain level, 18, 20, you know, 22 handicapper, somewhere around there, I would definitely, you know, keep stats. You know, I have all my students track their stats. You know, they can even use on my website, they can use a shot tracker app where they can go on after the round. If they hit the fairway, not only if they hit the fairway, but if you missed it left or right. So you can actually see, you know, yeah, I missed 60% of my fairways, but of those 60, I missed 90% of them to the right. So that's something we need to work on. We know which way they're missing. You know, like I talked about earlier, I think the putting stat can be a little misleading if you look at it only with putting, because, you know, you could have 36 putts, but you hit 18 greens in a round, and you could shoot even par with 36 putts, but your first putts are always 40 feet. You know, but you look at it the other way. I think if you're going to keep your putting stats, you know, try and at least keep that first putt, and record, estimate about how long it is, so you can get an idea. All right, well, I'm struggling from inside 10 feet, but I'm putting, I've made a few 20 footers today, which is nice. So, you can kind of get an idea of where in your putting needs to be improved. I mean, I really think if you're trying to transition, and get better, keep stats. That way you know what to work on. So you have meaningful practice. You're practicing with a purpose, and you're not just randomly going out hitting balls.
Right. Right, exactly. Brad, let me ask you in this way. We'll go to Brad, then Gary will let you round out this question. I think, is there some validity to what Sandro is saying here, that maybe sometimes, and I'm not necessarily talking about keeping their own stats, but, you know, we do hear a lot on TV all the time, especially with the pros, and they're talking about that. Is it possible that sometimes maybe that the average player is getting too confused with a lot of these numbers, and maybe it's not just the stats, like keeping your score and number of putts and things like that, but, you know, when they're getting on some of these monitors and things like that, there's a lot of numbers being thrown. Are we sometimes over-educating the higher handicappers before really their time?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that depends on the person, obviously, the individual, how much concerned they are. I mean, there's great numbers out there. I mean, TrackMan does a great job in giving us numbers, but it's how we use the numbers as coaches and what we need to give them as far as the information. I mean, you can't give them, a higher handicapper, you can't give them every piece of it You know, like TrackMan measures so many things that, you know, I'm going to pick out two or three things that I want them to see and say, okay, you know, here's where you were. You know, your attack angle was minus five, and now it's maybe got down to minus two or whatever I'm trying to show them. And by changing some things in their swing, I said, here's what's changed. And the ball flight's changed, and the numbers changed on TrackMan. And that's good stuff for them. But as far as the stats, I mean, I'm not going to give a high handicapper a lot of information in terms of stats, in terms of, look, I want you to miss it one way. All good players miss it one way. They don't have three
right.
misses. They go straight left and right. They miss most of them right or miss most of them left. And we have to get the golf ball to do the same thing every time. If I want them to curve it, you know, to make it more of a drawer, and they draw it 7 yards sometimes and 10 yards sometimes and maybe even 20 yards sometimes, and I show them, look, a fairway is not built 10 yards wide. It's 40 yards wide. And so
right.
if I aim down the middle of the fairway, I've got 20 yards of fairway to play with on the left and the right, but I only have 20 yards. What I want to do for you is take you and move you into more of a drawer, aim down the right middle of the fairway. Now you've got 35 yards of fairway to play with. That's what we want to do, and that number they understand. It's not, you know,
right.
getting so caught up in numbers that they don't understand. Well, that makes sense, Brad. 20 yards, you know, I want to have more fairway to play with. Same thing for the greens. I want you to have more green to play with. So if you aim at the flag, you know, your golf ball doesn't go straight, so why would you aim at the flag? All I want to do is get
right,
you on the
right.
green. So aim at the right middle of the green. Play your draw. If it draws 10 yards, you're fine. 15 yards, you're fine. 20 yards, you're fine. You're on the green. So I think, you know, helping them understand, you know, the simple stats, as I would call them, things that help them understand, look, I want the golf ball to move the same way every time. It may move more than we want it to, but it's going to move the same way every time. And that way they can use more of the green and more of the fairway. And those stats I think they can understand.
Right, and that's going to help them to be a lot more consistent. Gary, let me ask you the question this way, and see if we can, you know, answer it a little bit differently here. Do you think the stats are more useful or more important for the instructor to have a handle on, or the student, or both, and why? Is it more benefit? Are those numbers more beneficial for us? Let's say in our teaching, is it more useful to us to have that information, or more important for us to have it, and maybe not as important for the student, or is it both?
Well, I'll make a little differentiation between what I'm going to call stats and, you know, maybe like the launch monitor readings or impact data. From a stats standpoint, you know, the results-based information, number of putts, strokes gained doing strokes gained driving, strokes gained putting. I think that answer comes with, it depends on the mind of the student. You know,
right.
your engineer or accountant type mind is going to have a little more of a propensity to identify with some of these things. I think also, though, it's our responsibility and along with the student to set parameters and guidelines, and I even go as far as to say some of the rules. I mentioned once a month as an example of how often you look at it. So I think that
right.
that you need to really know your student. So I think that it can be extremely important for the, you know, more of the, we'll call it left brain analytical type thinker to have some peace in knowing there's a measurable way to do things. But for your more creative side brain, I think you're going to run into some, it's probably more beneficial for the instructor than the student. And then it's your job to translate the message. As far as the impact numbers go, I agree with Brad very much. You know, those type of TrackMan, that data, TrackMan and FlightScope, I think that it's our responsibility to really focus on some key numbers as applies. You know, we focus on one or two at a time. And a lot of people take satisfaction because a lot of times we're trying to, for lack of a better word, sell ourselves out there, you know, okay, you're doing great, you know, you're really looking in the right direction. For some people, that's not enough for them. And to be able to see some measurable improvement, even though the flight isn't perfect
right.
yet or whatever it is, just to be able to know that they're doing something along in the realm of the process development and to see that measurable improvement is important. Some people don't have any attachment to that. So I think it's really just, I know we have in this a lot of time, it comes down to the student, their mind, their personality, and things like that.
Well, and I also think it depends on the learning process. I mean, some people, and I'll throw myself in here, you know, I'm more of a visual person, so I like to see the results myself as far as, you know, seeing the ball flight and so forth, whereas some students, you know, like you just indicated, Gary, you know, sometimes you might not see the physical changes might not be, you know, huge at this moment, but the stats may show a different story and say that, you know, there's improvement in certain areas, and that's going to give them the feedback that they're looking for. So I think, and I agree with what everybody said. Sorry, go ahead.
I apologize for cutting off. I was going to say,
okay.
A lot of times changes are very uncomfortable, and they don't feel right, no matter what it is. And people are a little bit weirded out by that. And it's helpful to say, okay, you know, even though it feels this way or so on and so forth, the ball's starting to fly better, or you're starting to get this or that, or your results. But look at these numbers. We're doing better. You know, and that gives people a little bit of an encouragement to get over the just the way it just feels sometimes. You know, it doesn't feel right, or it feels different. It's probably the right word.
Right. And I suspect you know, Sandro, in his question, you know, he raises a very valid question, though, and in all fairness, you know, we understand from the business side the importance of these numbers and how they can benefit. But I agree with him that I think sometimes the magazines, you know, because they're trying to explain certain things in a very short period of time, they're just throwing a lot of numbers, not really explaining the importance of why it is important to have this information. So I think I can see it from his standpoint that it can be a little bit information overload, and they're not understanding the purpose, and it's not being put in a proper perspective. So maybe that's partially our fault for not explaining the importance of why these stats are needed and why they need to know this information and why we need to know this information. But I think, you know, sometimes in the course of the magazines and even on TV, you know, they're under time constraints, of course, with TV, so they're just sort of throwing a lot of numbers out there, and that people are saying, well, why do I need to know that? Or, you know, obviously, you know, putting stats and things like that, I think most people get, but there's other numbers that they hear, and they just don't understand the purpose of. So I think, you know, maybe if we explain a little bit more, as you guys have just done, I think people will understand that these stats are their friend, if you will, for lack of better words. But some great answers, guys, and thanks for the input. And Sandro, up in Alberta, fellow Canuck, I hope that we helped to answer your question. Stats are important, but when they have to be put in the proper perspective. So make sure that if you're working with a teacher professional up there in Canada, that you help get him to explain a little bit the importance of how these stats are going to help your golf game. Great question and great answer, guys. I'm trying to think of the order. Brad, we're going to start with you on this one. Robbie from Dallas, okay. Texas, and I'm assuming Robbie, the way it's spelt, is a guy. You never know these days. Names can confuse, so I apologize if I'm getting this wrong, but it doesn't say I'm a guy or anything, but I'm guessing by the question. Robbie from Dallas, Texas says, I play pretty regularly, as most of you know. Texas is famous for having some real hard pan. Some hard ground there, and as Harvey Penick used to talk about in his little red book about the Texas courses, he says, do you have any suggestions for playing off harder than normal fairways? And I'm sure we can throw the greens in there. So, Brad, here's a great question that we haven't really had on the panel yet this far this year is, you know, Texas can really dry out those fairways. A lot of the guys, from Tom Kite to Ben Crenshaw, talked about that, even Lee Trevino, much more so than here in the Southeast. You're playing on some hard fairway sometimes. How do you handle the shots a little bit differently? Go ahead, Brad.
Well, I mean, not a whole lot different, but the key to a hard fairway is that there's no question that you've got to catch balls in ground. I mean, if you're ever trying to come in too shallow on the way down your downswing and you hit behind the golf ball, it's going to bounce off that hard turf and come up, and obviously hit a lot of top shots. So it's got to be more of an impact where you have a little steeper angle of attack, but it has to be balled in ground. And, you know, I wouldn't say that for all players, especially down here in the South. Our fairways are a little softer and a little different grass. But, you know, that's probably the key element there. And, again, you know, most golfers' problems in that I see are people that are too steep on the way down, and the clubs, you know, almost coming down at such steep angles, they hit on top of the golf ball, they catch very fast shots. What we have to do is get them, you know, probably a little bit more on a shallow angle first, and then move them into more of a neutral position. I think that all good players that have gone through a phase in becoming a better player, they've gone through a hooking phase, and because most golfers are slicers, we move them into more of a hooking phase and then move them into more of a neutral position. But there's no question on hard fairway, you have to catch more ball than ground. Now, for little pitch shots around the green, they've got to learn how to use the bounce. I mean, that's why that sandwich is designed that way. And most golfers are very scared of that shot. But if I use the bounce and have a steep approach to the golf ball, it won't dig, but it will bounce, and you know, I can catch the golf ball pretty cleanly that way. It's kind of like a bunker shot, if you will.
Yeah.
So bounce is important as far as shots around the green. And then in full swings, it's got to be more ball than ground.
Okay. Great answer, Brad. Thank you. Gary, let's see if we can spin this one, no pun intended, a little bit differently. You know, one of the things, too, that I think, you know, people have to factor in, obviously, when you're playing on a little harder ground, is you have to make allowances for distance control as well. So let's tackle it from that standpoint, number one, and then also, is there anything else you want to add to what Brad had just said?
Brad covered the first portion marvelously well based on my knowledge base, so maybe Michael will have something there, but I don't. But as far as how you, I would think of, you know, from the course management standpoint and how you chart out a golf course, you may have, for example, 180 yards to lay up. You better not pull out your 180-yard club, quote-unquote. You need to have a club you know, and let's just say there's no wind. I know in Texas there probably will be, but let's just say there's no wind. You might be flying that golf ball 140 yards. It'll roll out another 30, you know, give or take, and that's going to lay you up to 170 yards where you're 10 yards short of a hazard. The same also holds true for as you're sort of, let's say you're playing a practice round and you're plotting your distances off the tee and, you know, you have you know, 250 yards to a given area. That might be a three wood for an advanced player at some point. Whereas now, you know, he or she might be looking at even as much as a little as a hybrid, you know, a club they're hitting like 210. So you have to really adjust for the extra roll and the firmness, and then also furthermore know how to, you know, plan for wind, you know, on top of those firm fairways.
Right. Exactly. You know, Michael, before I bring you on here, an interesting point. When I was a young fellow and I was learning, taking up golf at a very early age, my father, who was quite an accomplished player at the time, he used to actually make me practice off hard pins. He said, you know, before you go and hack up the golf course, I want to make sure you can hit the ball. So he would always, you know, make some difficult situations. And a lot of times he would actually make me hit out of everything from hitting out of divots, and he would find a, you know, an area that was sort of dried out, and he would make me hit shots from there. And one of the things, Michael, I want to ask you this, if you know, this is something that you would consider as well. What he suggested at the time, and I'm only talking very minimal amount, but just to choke up just ever so slightly on the grip, so that it's not, I mean, obviously you want to hit down, you still want to hit down and compress the ball, as Brad had talked about. But just to avoid, you know, getting too deep, just choke up ever so slightly on the club to make sure that you're still going to make good contact, but to avoid getting too deep on that hard ground. Would that be something that you might suggest to some of your students? And what other thoughts you
might have? Yeah, I mean, if they're getting too steep on the ball, yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, one of the things, you know, in Pennsylvania, we don't get a whole lot of hard pan stuff. I mean, you know, we have bent grass that usually comes out pretty easily, and you know, unless it's towards the end of summer when we're having, you know, some droughts or anything like that. But you know, but I mean, I think the easiest way to go about it, like Brad said, it's paramount to hit the ball first. You have to hit the ball first. If you don't, it's going to be bad. I mean, one of the things I like to do is, you know, give my students a go-to shot, and a lot of times it's that three-quarter shot, grip down a little bit. Make a what the feeling of a three-quarter length swing, and just make sure you get ball first contact and, you know, off a hard pan because it's so important. And, you know, and it kind of goes the same way for super wet grass. You hit it a little bit fat on super wet grass, you're going to kind of have, you know, a similar result where the ball's not going to go where you want it to go.
Right.
You know, but just make sure that you're making a swing that's controllable. To, you know, just choke down a little bit, make an abbreviated follow through. You know, it kind of reminds me of the tin cup Roy McAvoy swing. You know, it's a, you know, that was filmed in Texas. You know, just try. And plus, you know, in Texas, you get a lot of wind, too. So, you know, those three-quarter shots will flight the ball a little bit lower, you know, and let the ball land short and roll it up. Just, you know, like Gary said, make sure you choose the appropriate club to fly at the number that you want to fly it. Don't think about the 180 number. You know, if the front of the green's 160, maybe try and fly at 165 and just let it release to the hole. You know, obviously, that's a little bit more of an advanced, you know, more for the advanced golfer, trying to pick your number exactly like that. But, you know, just keep it as simple as possible. You know, grip down a little bit, make sure you catch the ball first, and, you know, just turn through to the target. Don't think too much about your golf swing, just think ball contact. You know, if I gave you a baseball and told you to throw it to me, you wouldn't think about how you were going to throw it. You would just make sure that you throw it to me. So when you get in a situation like that, just make sure you're focusing on your target, grip down, make a three-quarter swing, strike the ball first, and send the ball to your target. You know, that's... You know, and it, you know, like Brad said, with the, especially the shots around the green, the hard pan shots with the bounce, you know, with the firmer the ground, the less bounce you're gonna you would want to use. So just make sure that your wedges, you know, have the proper amount of bounce. In Texas, if you have 12 degrees of bounce, I'd imagine you're probably gonna struggle a little bit. Just like up here when it's soft, if you have 4 degrees of bounce, you're gonna struggle. It's like taking a steak knife through water. It's just gonna it's not gonna do anything. It's just going through. So. you know, but making sure the bounce is correct is extremely important, as you know, just as well as technique is extremely important. Make the equipment work for you, not the other way around.
Exactly. Well said. Great answers, guys, all three of you. And Robbie, if I could make one suggestion to you, you might want to consider maybe taking a trip east and playing here in the south a little bit and get off of that hard pan, or now that it's summer months, you might even want to head up to Pennsylvania and play some great courses up in that area and just give yourself a little bit of a break from the hard pan. But thanks for sending an email, and we appreciate your question here. Okay, I got one here that this really I thought was kind of interesting. Jesse, again, I'm not sure, and I apologize whether this is male or female. I believe it's male, but from Denver, Colorado. And Jesse writes and he says, I've played golf for many years. Over 20, in fact. I never in the past have taken lessons, therefore I probably have some pretty bad habits. I've been thinking about connecting with a pro in my area and wanted to ask the panel your thoughts on whether or not I should after all this time. Should I make changes to my game at this point? So here's somebody that's played for at least a minimum of 20 years, so I'm guessing probably in his 40s to between 40s and 50s, I would assume, if not older. And Gary, we're going to start off with you this time, start back at the beginning of the panel. What would your suggestion be to start off for Jesse? Somebody that's played a long time, probably ingrained some bad habits, I'm sure. What would you suggest to be the place to start?
Firstly, I would identify and have a clear picture for what my goals and intentions are with getting help and getting lessons, because you can't just throw – well, you can, but I don't suggest throwing yourself in blindly and then just going with it. I think you have to really know what you're looking for, trying to do, and be honest with yourself based on your time your time availability, your budget, and your interest of the game. Once you have those things established, I then recommend interviewing a minimum of two, really three probably is good, coaches or instructors, and see what they ask you, see how they go about things, see what they feel. And then, you'll know which one, partly from what you're hearing literally and also from what you're sensing through your instincts, you'll know who you feel is a good match for you. If none of those three happen to be, then you continue to work at that. But I feel like you have to, really take that protocol is probably a good place to start.
Yeah, I agree with that. Brad, I'm gonna Michael finished off there, I'm going to jump to you on this one. And let me just ask it from this perspective, if I can, Brad. You know, obviously, Jesse doesn't indicate what handicap is. So I'm assuming that obviously they want to improve their game. But I think probably part of their uncertainty of going that route with an instructor is they probably figure, you know, even though I've got some bad habits, I know where my game stands now. I don't want to necessarily get into a situation, reinvent the wheel, and maybe it ends up being worse, which is probably going to happen for a little while. So there's probably some hesitation there. So if you had somebody that come up to you and asked you personally, Brad, that very question, obviously you're an instructor and you want to work with them, but what differently, if anything, or what in addition would you advise them to what Gary had just talked?
Well, they came to me and said they want to improve their golf game, and you know I would definitely have them, all my first-time students, fill out a profile and find out their weaknesses and strengths. And at the very bottom of the page it says your goals. I mean, what do you want to get out of this? You know, what are you looking for? And you know that's going to give me a pretty good indication about what I can do with the student. Other questions like how often do you practice? How often do you play? Have you taken lessons before? Those kind of questions give me kind of a sense and a feeling of where they are and where they want to go. You know, anyone that wants to take a golf lesson, I mean, any golfer, period, really, wants really three things. They want the golf ball to do something better. They want the golf ball to do something better more often. And they want the bad shots not to be so bad. That's what every golfer wants. I don't care what shot, putting, chipping, pitching. That's what every golfer wants. They want the golf ball to do something better, do it more often, and the bad shots, which is kind of the key, not to be so bad. So, you know, reinventing the wheel, I mean, I'm going to take what he's got and fix what he's got. You know, a lot of guys say, Brad, well, I don't really have a method. I just try to take what they have and make it better. Well, we all do that. I mean, that's not anything special. We got to take what they've got and make it better. So based on the student, I have to really understand about what they really want because, you know, they say, but I don't want to get any worse. Well, I look at it this way. I'm going to make it better, but you've already been hitting bad shots, and you hit some bad shots even after the lesson. But you were already hitting bad shots before the lesson. But I'm going to make your bad shots not so bad, make your good ones better, and make them happen more often. Will it be different? Well, sure it will be. I mean, I can't, you know, the other guy's points, you know, it's going to feel different. If it doesn't feel different, we haven't done anything, you know. If it feels good, it's the same thing you were doing, same bad stuff you were doing before. So, you know, I'm going to definitely help them understand that, you know, we're going to change some things and make it better, but I got to really understand what you really want out of this because if you just want to say, but I don't want to change anything, I just want to hit the ball better, I said, look, you've come to the wrong guy. I said, you need to go find somebody that's not going to find something that's not going to change something and make you better. You know, I don't think that instructor out there lives because you have to change something to make it better. And if they're not willing to change, then, you know, I'm not going to put some ideas in their head that's going to say, you know, look, I'm not going to change a thing and make you better. It doesn't happen that way.
No, exactly. Well said. Michael, I'm going to, of course, flip this just a little bit. Let's go on to the assumption that Jesse is a pretty decent player, but obviously needs some work on his game. Do you think maybe a different approach might be if Jesse's reluctant to maybe make a lot of swing changes, maybe focus on, but maybe still could use some lessons, rather than focus on changing what Jesse has as far as ball striking and things like that, what about maybe working more on course management, helping him manage his game with what he's working with? In other words, he's got the tools. They may not be the best tools, but would you maybe, if you sense that he's reluctant to want to make a lot of changes, maybe approach it from a course management end? Well, that might be a better way to handle that.
I mean, you could.
Michael, sorry.
I think you could. But like Brad said, I don't think, you know, he's getting the best bang for his buck if he's not, you know, if he doesn't want to make a change, then, you know, you're wasting your money, you're wasting your time. You go to a place if you think you're broken or you want to get fixed, you know, you go to a place to make a change. You know, if you're if you're going to go there and, you know, and do it that way, then you're wasting everybody's time. I look at it this way. If the best players in the world want to go and they get lessons every week, some of them daily at times, from their instructor on their golf swing, on their short game, on their course management. I think course management is definitely part of it, but it's just a small piece of the puzzle. You know, that all ties
right
together. You know, if you're making a mistake in your golf swing just by saying, all right, well, I sliced, you know, we've all had that guy that comes to us and said, hey, I hit a 50-yard slice. I don't want to change anything. Can you teach me how to play with that? Well, yeah, aim 30,
right,
you know, aim 50 yards left and put a Band-Aid on it, and eventually the Band-Aid is going to fall off. You know, if you're coming to me for a lesson, I don't put Band-Aids on people's swing. I'm going to fix you. Yeah, you know, you should get better right away. Well, you still hit bad shots, but like Brad said, you're already hitting bad shots. What's the worst that can happen?
Yep.
You're not playing golf for money. You know, just, well, maybe not for money, but you get my point. You're not playing golf for the amount of money the tour players are playing for. You're just having fun. I'm going to help you have more fun and take it that way. But, you know, to directly answer your question, I think, you know, you can definitely help them with course management, but I think you can only do so much. For the better player, yeah, I think, you know, if they're, you take them on the golf course and they're 150 yards out and they're trying to play punch hooks in with their 165-yard club, then, yeah, we might have an issue. But, you know, I think, you know, if we're talking about a better player, I think there's only so much you can do with, as with anybody, with just course management. You know, it's just a piece of the puzzle. You know, you got to tie it all together. It's just, I think golf instruction is turning more towards, and I don't know how you guys feel about it, but I think golf instruction is turning more towards total game coaching as opposed to just instruction of the golf. So I think it's always been that with a lot of the better instructors. But you watch the Golf Channel and, you know, stuff like that, and a lot of the talks about the full swing, which is a huge piece of the puzzle. But, again, it's just, you know, we got to talk about the entire
thing. Component. Well,
exactly.
It's like I talked about earlier in the segment that I'm going to be bringing out here in the next few weeks. You know, there's a lot of other components. It's not just one thing. And you can't just, as you said, Michael, you can't just throw a Band-Aid on it. Guys, I need to move along, and thank you for answering that. I think we gave Jesse some things to think about. The last question here I've got is from Anne, a young lady from Boston, Massachusetts, who's actually from Boston, sorry. And she's got an interesting question here. She says, I played golf growing up with my parents, who were pretty accomplished golfers in their day, but haven't played for a few years. She got married about a year ago, and her husband, who plays regularly, suggested that she dust off her old clubs so that they can play together, which kudos to him, because a lot of husbands might not be as so inclined to do that. But her question really is, she's not sure where to start. She played to roughly about a 15 handicap when she sort of put them away. Why she stopped, I don't know, but I guess she got busy with other things. Really would like to, you know, she would really like for them to be able to play together, but she's a little nervous since she hasn't picked up a club in a while. So her question is, where does she, how does she jumpstart her game at this point? She hasn't played for a number of years, doesn't say how many, but obviously hasn't played for a while, but she's nervous. And she's got a new hubby there that she probably is worried about impressing and embarrassing herself in front of, so she wants to make sure she gets her game back to a respectable level. Gary, let's start with you.
Sure. Well, I'll answer this the best I can, again, without knowing the entire situation.
Yeah, I know.
I would recommend, my initial instinct says to hit the driving range, to jumpstart your game at least once or twice on your own. I would recommend being without anybody else, not having any, extreme, amounts of, you know, swing thoughts being barked at you. Just let yourself kind of be yourself and, you know, get back into the, no pun intended, but the swing of things. And if that is not who she is or how she is as a person with a decent amount of ability, then I would say do exactly the opposite and get lessons. Do the whole thing I just mentioned earlier, just to define your goals based on time, budget, interest, and get with a coach who will understand, honor that, and match those thoughts for you. So it depends on the personality, but I take one of those two polar opposite approaches.
Perfect. Well said. Michael, your thoughts on that? Pretty much the same, or do you have anything different you might
want? Yeah, I think it's all similar. I mean, go hit some balls and have fun with it. You know, I mean, it's great that she wants to get back into the game. That's awesome. I mean, you know, we need more of that to grow our game. I think another route to go, we host a lot of these at Bellwood, is ladies' clinics. They're mm-hmm. extremely popular at Bellwood. You know, we do some schools with wine, and there's a lot more places that are starting to do that, you know, like a wine and dine clinic or, you know, something like that, and, you know, or a get golf ready program, even though she's played golf before, but it'd be a nice reintroduction to the game. They kind of say, hey,
right.
here's, you know, let's go over the fundamentals again. You know, and if, you know, if she's a little shy about going on a one-on-one basis, you know, and again, like Gary said, we don't know the whole situation, but if that
right.
is the case, she can go through a clinic type setting. You know, and that's what a lot of our ladies do on a fairly regular basis, is, you know, every couple weeks do a ladies' school. And they're a lot of fun. You know, you're going to learn a lot. You know, you're going to get some good work on your fundamentals. And then you'll get, the occasional one-on-one time with the instructor, depending on, you know, how the instructor decides to run the program. But, yeah, I think it's great. Just, you know, get out there and have fun with it. Have fun with your house. And don't be afraid of playing well. We all have our bad days. And you don't want to beat him. That's
sure.
a sure way to be getting in an argument. You know, don't beat him. Let him win. just have fun, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I just to add to that, I think fun is the optimum word really to use at this point. You know, go to enjoy it. I agree with what both of you said. And Gary, you started off with, you know, really going out and just hitting some balls on your own at the range and you know, maybe do a little putting and chipping and things, just kind of a little, you know, your own self-assessment, if you will. And if you feel that, you know, it needs to go elsewhere and get some professional help, then by all means do that. Brad, I'm going to bring you in here to round out this question. And let me just say this. One of the things, let me just put it this way. Obviously, I think you probably agree with the other two to start off, just to get out to the range and dust the clubs off and hit a few shots and maybe make some putts and so forth, just to kind of see things were set. One thing I've noticed, and I would certainly advise her, if she does feel that she needs to seek some professional help, the number one thing I would say, especially being a newlywed, do not go to your husband's coach or teacher. Find your own. Not to knock him or her that they're not a good instructor, but I think that, you know, when you're trying to get couple golf going here, I think you need to have your own instructor who's going to focus on you and not worried about what Jim over here or Steve over here is doing or whatever her husband's name is. He's going to focus on Ann, and it's going to be separate. Would you agree with that? And anything else that you want to add on how we would advise Ann to jumpstart her game?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of couples that actually take lessons together. I have a lot of people that I work with, husband and wife that I work with, but I don't work with them together. And, you know, if the husband ever is there, you know, hitting balls during the lesson and makes some kind of comment, you know, I'll have to, you know, pull him to the side and say, you know, what she's doing and what you're doing are totally different. I mean, what I'm working with her is what she needs to work on, and what you need to do is what you need to work on. So, you know, I'm going to make a polite way of just interjecting that. But, you know, even for beginners, you know, I like to see what they have what they have. I mean, I'm a
right.
beginner. I don't give them any instruction. I want to see what I have to work with, what kind of athlete I have. So, you know, I agree with both Michael and Gary. You know, go hit some golf balls first and just kind of get back in the swing of things and then take a lesson. And you know, again, you know, they may say, Brett, I don't know how to hold anymore. I don't know. I say, you do whatever you want to do right now because I've got to see what you've got. And whatever you've got, I've got to take that and fix it. To Michael's point, you know, I don't give Band-Aids. I don't give you a quick remedy. I strive for quick success, but I'm going to fix it and based on cause and effect and help them understand that. So their points were great. The husband and wife thing, yeah, I work with both husbands and wives, but I do not work with them together because that's a remedy for some stress. I don't need that in my life, and I know they don't need it in their lives. So, you know, again, I've got to see what I've got to work with, you know, so
yeah.
I'm going to take whatever they've got at that time and make it better.
Exactly. Well said. Let me just add a final thought here.
The other thing that I would suggest, Ann, is this. I certainly agree with everything that all three of the coaches here have said, quote, and certainly see what you've got on your own first, and then certainly seek out a teacher professional. And I personally would suggest that you try and find somebody that they can still be at the same facility that you're, you know, if your husband plays or is a member somewhere. But, you know, I would try if you can, you know, work with somebody different. And if not, then just make it very clear that you want to sort of keep it separate. But the other thing that I would do, and Michael raised a valid point, there's a lot of different great women's leagues and programs out there. What I would also suggest is it's great that you want to play and your husband wants you to play, and that's certainly an encouraging sign. But I would also encourage you to, in addition to playing together, is go out and play, you know, find some ladies out there that also play and join a women's group or something that you can go out and play separate so that you've got something that you're not just always playing together all the time. Now, you know, you're obviously in the honeymoon phase and you want to be together, and that's great, but you know, roll it down the hill about 20 years and you may not feel that way. So, you know, it's nice to have something out. You have to have outside interests. And I think that she obviously enjoyed playing golf years ago and has an opportunity to play with her spouse. And I think that's wonderful. And I think that's fantastic, and go for it. But I think you also have something outside of it as well. Gives you something fresh to talk about. Say, hey, we played last week at such and such, and, you know, gives you something different. So you're not doing the same thing all the time. So, that's what I would suggest, Ann, is do your own sort of self-assessment, see where your game is at, and then go and get some professional help if you need some tweaking or some follow-up, and try and find somebody, you know, separate that from what your husband may be taking. And then also, as Michael suggested, maybe get involved with, you know, a ladies group or something like that, just to have some different people to play with as well. So that's what I would suggest. And guys, I want to thank you for I said stepping up and being on the panel tonight, the day before July 4th, one of the biggest holidays here in the United States. And I appreciate you guys pitching in tonight and helping my audience.
Thank you, Ted.
Yeah, thanks.
Not a problem.
Thank you very
guys,
much.
Very quickly, we'll. Not a problem. Gary, we'll start with you if you want to just give a quick reminder to everybody how they can get in touch with you or where they can get more information on your golf.
Sure. I have the website of GaryOcinoGolf.com, O-C-C-H-I-N-O, and also SamuraiGolfSling.com. Will be two of the many. I have a few of them, so that'll be good.
All right, appreciate it. And Michael, I'll let you go, and then we'll finish with Brad. Michael, how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, just go to my website. It's michaelwheelergolf.com, really breaking the mold there, first, last name, then golf.com. So, you know, just go to that. It's got all my contact information, all the information. You know, we do anything from private lessons with FlightScope, JC Video, and all that good stuff, all the way up through two-day schools, kickoff ready, junior schools, ladies schools. You know, we'll do just about anything. We're at, in basically, you know, southeast Pennsylvania there in Pottstown, kind of right between Reading and Philly. So, you know, just use that website, you know, shoot me an email, give me a call, whatever works.
Perfect. And keep playing well, Michael. Great round. I'm not going to throw you under the bus and let the audience know what you did, but great round, and keep it going and enjoy it. And, of course, Mr. Brad Redding, let's finish with you. Let the folks know how they get in touch with you if they wish.
They can contact me at brad@bradreddinggolf.com. That's my email. Website, same thing, bradreddinggolf.com. They can follow me on Twitter and Facebook, which is also Brad Redding Golf. We do private lessons half-day in feeding out golf schools, come down to Myrtle Beach and enjoy the beach, and come over and take some time and visit my lesson tee.
Sounds great. Guys, again, happy 4th to all of you and your families, and have a great and safe holiday, and thank you very much for pitching in Coach's Corner tonight, and I'll talk to all of you real soon.
Thanks, Ted.
Thank you.
All right, have a great evening, guys. Thanks. Okay, that was another Coach's Corner, and special thanks to Gary Okino, Michael Wheeler, and Brad Redding for stepping up tonight. I appreciate it on the eve of July 4th, and thanks, guys, for pitching in.
My guest, it looks like we're ready to go here, is Mr. Stephen Yellen. And he has authored a really interesting book I want to talk to him a little bit about here in the next hour, called The Fluid Motion Factor, A Revolutionary Understanding of Golf. And we're going to talk about where you can get your hot little hands on that and when it's going to be available. But before I do that, I just want to read just a little bit about Stephen, just to give you some background here. Stephen actually began his athletic career playing tennis at the age of 12. He competed locally and nationally and won the Florida State High School Singles Championship in 1971 and was a member of the winning championship team. Recruited heavily, and he chose the University of Pennsylvania, where he was the number one player on the team. He was a member of the All-Ivy League tennis team in 1973 and actually won over somebody I'm sure all of you will recognize, John McEnroe, in a dual match during his college career. And as a senior at Penn, Yellen had an extraordinary zone experience, as he puts it, that radically changed his understanding of sports. It was because of this experience that was unlike anything he'd ever experienced on the court before. Now, I know he's started in tennis, but he's obviously going to bring it to golf and talk a little bit about that tonight. So let me bring Stephen out here, and we'll talk a little golf tonight. Stephen, welcome to Golf Talk Live.
Thanks, Ted. Thanks for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Not a problem. I don't know if you were listening at all or could hear, but I just gave a little bit of background on you here. I know that you started, as I said, in actually tennis and played up against somebody that we all would recognize, John McEnroe, and actually beat him back in your college days. Talk just very quickly a little bit about your time back in college. And then we'll get into about your book and about the fluid motion.
Okay, yeah, sure. So I had a great time playing tennis for the University of Pennsylvania. I played 4 years. I played number one most of my time there. And in a dual match when I was a senior, we played against Port Washington and John McEnroe. I was up against, and no one has really heard of him, like they know him now. But within about 30 seconds, I realized that this kid was a genius. I never saw anyone hit a ball like this so effortlessly and so fluidly with so much power and grace. And fortunately, I had my A game that day. It was my favorite surface, indoor clay, and I managed to win. So, you know, he's still talking about that loss to Yellen. It stifled his career for a few years.
Yeah, I'm sure he is. But that's pretty incredible. Now obviously you at some point, I don't know whether you still playing tennis and that, but obviously you're working in the golf industry now, and I wanted to give you an opportunity. We'll talk a little bit about the book. The Fluid Motion Factor, A Revolutionary Understanding of Golf. Now, is that currently available now, or is it just about to come out?
No, it's going to be – it just went to the printers this week. It's going to be available probably in 3 to 4 weeks.
Okay, and where is it going to be available?
On my website, fluidmotiongolf.com.
Okay. I wasn't sure. Is it also going to be – is it just strictly going to be through the website, or is it going to be through Amazon?
No,
at
it's
going to
be on Amazon. You get it – yeah, the usual suspects. You know, you can buy it on Kindle and Amazon, and hopefully some of the chains will pick it up, and hopefully it'll take off.
Okay, sounds perfect. All right, obvious question. Explain first off a little bit what the fluid motion factor is, and then we'll sort of progress into how it applies in golf, how it's found in golf.
Sure. So there is one process in the mind that produces fluid motion in any sport. And I have a company along with my partner, former World Series hero Buddy Biancolana, that has taught this program in 7 professional sports simply because motion is produced identically regardless of what sport you're playing. And
right.
Everyone has this experience when they play well, whether it's golf or tennis or basketball or baseball or any sport, is that they walk off the court or the course or the field, and you ask them, what did it feel like? You played so well today. And they say, well, the first thing that they usually say, and I've asked this to a number of very good golfers, how did you feel when you played your best? They say, well, you know, I wasn't thinking.
Yeah.
And everyone knows that experience, that sort of zone experience where time slows down, the mind becomes very quiet, and the body just feels so liquid and so powerful. Well, those three experiences, which are very abstract and which really are the entrance, sort of the keys to the kingdom in any athletic endeavor, they are produced by this one process in the brain. And I'll just very briefly go over it, not to get too technical, but
sure.
when someone generates emotion, when someone wants to hit a golf ball or throw a baseball or hit a tennis serve, they generate a signal in the brain, an intention to perform that motion. If they didn't generate an intention, the signal, then the body won't move at all. Now, there's two parts of the brain that are really crucial for producing fluid motion. One is called the prefrontal cortex, which is also the discriminating intellect, and the other in this discussion is called the motor system. Now, when
right.
someone has their best outing, or they just hit a career shot or have a career round or play a career tournament, the signal during the motion bypasses the prefrontal cortex, goes right to the motor system, and it's the motor system which communicates with the body to produce motion. And this process I have labeled as the fluid motion factor because it's the only way to produce fluid motion in the body. Any neuroscientist would say the same thing. But, and it's a big but, golfers never know when they're going to access that process. They're in and
right.
they're out. They hit a career shot, and then all of a sudden, they're OB on the next drive. It felt so simple, and then it gets real complex real quick. And, oh, go ahead, Dad.
No. What I was going to say is, you know, that happens in every. It's even on the range. You know, you'll maybe hit two or three really good shots, and all of a sudden the next one, you know, you've hit a slice or a hook or something like that. You're scratching your head wondering, you know, what happened here? I've hit the last three or four shots, you know, almost perfectly, and suddenly now all of a sudden I can't. You know, the next couple of shots are bad. You know, this is something that all golfers of all levels, even the best of the best, at some time have that happen. So, you know, how do they overcome that? You know, how do they deal with that?
Well, you know, it's a very good question, and there's a very, very fundamental missing element in all sports instruction, especially in golf instruction. I teach at David Ledbetter's Academy at Champions Gate, and David realized this when I spent time with him, that this program fills in that missing gap because it's so true.
Right.
Guy goes to the range, he's just crushing ball after ball. Let's go from the range to the course. He's just crushing
yep.
the ball, hitting it pure, doing what he wants to do with the ball, flighting it correctly. Everything is free-flowing. He gets to the first tee, and it's like, what happened? Where did it go?
Yeah.
And
yep.
golf is all about motion. Motion is all about the muscles. The operating system of the muscles is in the brain. It has nothing to do with sports psychology. I'm not a sports psychologist. This program has nothing to do with sports psychology. This program is based on how to access one process in the mind that produces fluid motion in the body. Now, how do golfers deal with it? Well, let's take an example everyone knows from this year. Let's take the back nine of the Masters this year on Sunday with
right.
Bubba and Jordan. Okay, so
mm-hmm.
Jordan's feeling no pain, and he's got, I think, a couple-shot lead going into the eighth or ninth hole, correct? Then
mm-hmm. yep.
all of a sudden, his swing gets fast at the top. He can't find the slot on the way down. He's pushing it right. Bubba, meanwhile, is feeling no pain. He's just,
yep.
you know, he's just sort of floating through the whole thing. And, you know, they asked Bubba, you know, what did it feel like on the back nine? And he made a very poignant remark that indicates he was accessing the fluid motion factor. He says, you know what? I don't know what I was doing. I wasn't. I don't even remember the last four holes. This is the back nine at the Masters. This is not. This is not your local Muni Championship. Okay. This,
right.
I don't remember
exactly
what I did. Okay. So what happened because of his experience, and of course, I'm sure when Jordan Spieth gets in this situation again, he's going to deal with it a little differently, and he'll be able to realize that, you know what, things were moving really, really fast out there, and I've just got to quiet my mind. That's the whole thing. The whole thing is about having silence in the mind when you play, because it's silence. It's the ability of the mind to be quiet that accesses the fluid motion factor. That's why when you ask any golfer, I mean, you ask Bubba after he won the Masters, Bubba, can you describe how you felt? You know, what were you doing out there? What did he say? Well, I don't remember too much of anything. And Tiger says the same thing in his prime. There was a DVD that came out maybe about 5 or 7 years ago. It was called Tracking the Tiger. And in it, he makes his very cryptic comment that if you didn't understand the dynamics of the fluid motion factor, you would think it's something from the Twilight Zone. He says, and I'm quoting, "There have been key shots in major tournaments where I took the club out of the bag and I didn't remember anything until I saw the ball land on the green." This is the back nine at Augusta, or the U.S. Open, or the PGA Championship, or the British Open. This is why he dominated golf for so long. It was not so much the quality of his swing. It was the quality of his silence that he was able to access his swing in pressure situations.
Do you think, Stephen, that, you know, and we can talk about either the pros or even at an amateur level, do you think that a lot of people get too much information in their head, too many swing thoughts, you know, going at once, that, and this maybe what happened, you know, in the back nine in Augusta, this is why, you know, Bubba was able to be so successful, is he didn't have a lot of things going on in his head. In fact, he didn't remember what was going on, and Tiger, of course, has done the same. Do you think that this is maybe what's killing a lot of people's golf game, is they're getting too much information, you know, going in their head at one time, that they're not able to really relax and just let the bodies, you know, and mind sort of work together naturally? Do you think that that's part of what's going on with a lot of people?
It's not part. It's killing golf.
Yeah.
This is why people quit. People quit because they feel they have all this information. They're reading all the golf magazines. They're watching the Golf Channel. They're thinking they've discovered the Holy Grail when someone says, okay, get the club in this position. They go out. They try to do it. It's very frustrating. Why spend 4 or 5 hours completely frustrated away from your family and you're spending $50, $60? And this is why David Ledbetter is so excited about this program. He uses it. Mm-hmm. His children went through it. It's because it simplifies everything. Everything has to be simple. Now, when someone is going through the developmental stages of learning golf, okay, you know what? You need some information here. But and here's the thing, Ted. There's something called muscle memory. You've heard of it, right?
Right. Yep.
Muscle memory is not located in the muscles. Muscle memory is located in the basal ganglia in the brain. And muscle memory is very similar to saving money in a savings account. Let's say you want to save $10,000. Mm-hmm. You go to the bank, fill out an application, you start putting $400 a month, $500, $600, whatever it is. Eventually, you have $10,000. Now, regardless of when you go to the bank, your $10,000 is there. You go to the bank on Tuesday, it's there. You go to the bank 2 years from now, it's there. It's exactly the same with muscle memory. Once someone can go to the range, drop a few balls, and hit solid shots, at that point, their swing can't break down. What breaks down is the ability to access what they already own. And all this information, which is floating around in their brain as some magical kinds of formula, if I can only get the club in this position, if I can only do this, what happens is that shuts down the fluid motion factor in a nanosecond. This is why in that 100-yard walk between the driving range, when someone's just flushing the ball, just really pure, and they go to the first tee, and all of a sudden they've got all these complicated formulas going on in their brain, they got no chance. You know what that's called, Ted? Two words. Las Vegas, okay?
Yep.
It's
exactly.
Las Vegas. You're rolling the dice. You don't know what you're going to get, okay?
Well, and it's like, you know, I equate it to this. You know, when I was younger and first taking up golf, one of the things that I always found very interesting is one of the very first, usually the first round or first maybe two rounds that I played at the beginning of the season, because obviously I grew up in Canada, so we had a limited season. But, the first spring thaw that I could dust off the clubs and go out there and play, I played some of my best golf. But then when I would sort of assess the round and start thinking about things, and then I'd start working on a few things and get out, then suddenly I would see things deteriorate a little bit and start having a lot of problems. And I think what it was, and I think this is really what you're alluding to here, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is, you know, once the brain starts to overanalyze everything, so much information gets put in there that the natural flow of things between brain and body gets interrupted. And ultimately what ends up happening is it doesn't work in a fluid motion. It's as you said, you're trying to put the club in a certain position, or you're trying to get down to impact in a certain way. Whereas at the beginning of the season, you're not really thinking about swing. You're just going out to the play. And I think this is really what some of the tour pros have done when they get out and around. They get into that zone. They're not thinking about their swing. They're not thinking about, getting things in a certain position. They're just out there playing the round. And a lot of times, once they've gotten in that zone, as Bubba did the last night of the Masters, is it no longer becomes swing mechanics or, positioning of the club or what have you. They're just playing the round. They're in the moment. Would that be accurate?
You are speaking the truth, okay? Now let me ask you the same question that I ask any pro that I work with, okay? And let's see what your response is. Are you ready for the question?
Sure.
Tell me how you felt when you played your best golf.
You know, going back to what I was just talking about, the truth is I really can't say. When I played my best golf, it was effortless, and I really didn't put a lot of thought in until after the round. It was, you know, then I would start to assess. But during the round, when I was hitting the ball well and playing well and scoring well, I was just enjoying the moment. I really didn't think about anything other than the fact that I was out here on a great golf course having a good time.
Everyone says the same thing. It was effortless. I wasn't thinking, correct?
Sure.
Everyone says the same thing. No one or very few people have a practice routine to set that condition up by design. It just sort of falls in their lap. It falls in their lap, and then they say, "Oh, this is great." And then they get off the court. They're finished with the round. They're driving home. They're analyzing, you know, how it felt. And all of a sudden, they start thinking, "You know, I finally got the club in this position that I wanted to get it in." And I finally had the right tempo. And I finally took the club the way I took it back, the way I wanted to take it back, in the right, you know, swing plane, you know, or coming down from the top. And then all of a sudden, they're out of that innocent that level of the mind, because they weren't thinking about that when they were playing. So what they do is they try to replicate the byproduct of what happens when you play well. This is a key point. They try to replicate the byproduct of accessing the fluid motion factor is the swing. Why go to the byproduct? Why not just access the ability of the brain physiology to work correctly so the body can access the muscle memory it already owns and produce fluid, solid golf shots? But, and it's a big but, it's a huge but. People don't know how to do that. And so they go to the byproduct. They don't go to the source. And I can't overemphasize enough, Ted, that my program has nothing to do with sports psychology. In fact, I've never even read a book on sports psychology before. I have no background in sports psychology. The origin of this program is I had a zone experience when I was a senior at the University of Pennsylvania. That was a life-transforming experience. It's like someone going out and shooting a 58 or a 57. And it was a very typical challenge match, and I walked off the court, and I was completely dumbfounded that I fell into this space because I never fell into it before. And I realized that this is going to be something that I'm going to have to figure out. And it took a long time to figure out, but I figured it out. Essentially, I figured it out.
let me ask you, playing a little devil's advocate here, is there, you know, is there a balance between, you know, finding a way to get into that zone and also being a little bit analytical? Because obviously as an instructor myself, and obviously, you know, I certainly don't play on tour, but players and instructors are going to look at things analytically at some point. Is there a happy balance that can be found? How do we sort of put it in perspective between, you know, playing in the zone and then, but still needing to be, because to be honest, we have to be realistic. I mean, we have to analyze our game in order to improve. We can't just all sort of go out there one day and just assume everything, you know, don't think about anything and everything's going to be like Bubba's back nine at the Masters. So how do we find balance between the two?
But Ted, remember, what are you trying to do when you play golf? You're just trying to replicate what you experienced when you played your best golf. Okay? That's what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can do that, then you are in very good shape. So when you played your best golf, were you analytical on the course?
No.
Were you analytical? No, right?
No,
everyone's going to say no.
No.
No. Okay. So if that's the best case scenario, why wouldn't you want to set that up all the time? Now,
right.
With that being said, there is a way to work on your golf swing intelligently using this program. And the analogy I give is when a potter wants to mold clay into a certain shape, what's the first thing he does to the clay? What does he do to the clay, first thing he does? He moistens it. He makes it malleable. He puts water on it. Because if the clay isn't malleable, and he puts
it
on the wheel, and he can't work with it. Now, when you're trying to work on your swing, what's the first thing in my world? It's actually not even my world. It's from a neurophysiological perspective. What's the first thing that you should be teaching your student, have your student experience? It's making the mind malleable, creating silence in the mind. Because then, when you create silence in the student's mind, and I've seen this, it's miraculous, actually, how quickly you can change someone's swing. When you create silence in the mind, you make the mind malleable, you access the fluid motion factor, then when the student gives his body an intention to do something, get the club in this position versus that position, the body is a complete slave to that. It says, yes, I will. You finally understand how I work here. I will do anything you want, versus the typical instruction is, okay, now, Mr. Student, Mrs. Student, I want you to get the club in this position. Well, what controls the muscles? The muscles don't control the muscles. You have to set up a situation where the mind-body connection is so acute, it's so tight, meaning that the mind is working the way it's supposed to work. When it gives the body an intention, the body immediately responds. So I have a certification program for PGA professionals, LPGA professionals, for coaches, that goes over this. It essentially, it teaches someone how to teach my program, and one of the main things in the certification program is how to change someone's swing very, very quickly using the understanding of setting, of accessing the fluid motion factor first.
Okay. Now, that being the case, how should we be teaching golf?
Oh, golf is not taught correctly, Ted. It's a blanket statement. It is not taught correctly. What you're doing is you're going to the wrong source first. You're going to the body. You're telling Mrs. Golfer, you're taking the club too far on the inside. I want you to take it straight back, okay? So she knows what she has to do. The teacher knows what she has to do, but she can't do it as consistently.
Right.
What you have to do is you have to be the intelligent potter. You have to create malleability in the mind. If you don't do this, and the great instructors, I've seen David Ledbetter teach, and he's a genius when he teaches. He sets this up in a very magical kind of way, but it's not systematic, and it's hit or miss.
Mm-hmm.
But when you set it up systematically, the first thing that you should teach any student in any sport is how to access the fluid motion factor so the brain physiology is working correctly. Absolutely. If you don't do that, you know what? Two words, Las Vegas. You're rolling the dice.
Yep.
Sometimes they get it. Sometimes they get it. Sometimes they don't get it. Sometimes they hit it well. Sometimes they don't hit it well. Everyone has the correct intellectual understanding of where the club should be on the way back, the correct understanding where it should be set on the at the top, how it should come down. That intellectual understanding does not necessarily equate into execution. Because unless you create that malleability in the mind, when the mind gives the body an intention to do something, sometimes it does it, sometimes it doesn't do it. Why take chances? Why play roulette?
Right.
Be systematic about it. So that's why I'm very excited about this certification program, because the PGA professionals, you can hear and watch. I did some YouTube videos of PGA professionals who have gone through the certification program, and they talk about their experience with teaching. It's actually quite breathtaking.
Now, obviously, you know, this would more than likely explain why some of the players on tour are able to sort of break through on tour and others are not. Is it because some are able to access this fluid motion system, if you will, in their mind a little easier than another player? Like, let's say, you know, obviously some players stand out, Tiger being in his prime, as you said, being an example. Jack Nicklaus was, of course, another one. There are some players that just seem to get into that zone, if you will, much easier. Is that part of the reason why that some of them are able to access that part of themselves better than others?
It's not part of the reason, Ted. It's the only reason. You go to a PGA tournament, and you go to the driving range, you see 140 picture-perfect swings. Am I right or wrong?
Yep. Sure. Oh, exactly.
And it's not even on the PGA Tour. You go to, you know, you go to web.com. You won't be able to tell the difference between, okay. So it's not the swing. It's not the swing. These guys look like they all have computer-generated swings.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ability to access the swing under pressure. And there's only one way you can do that. You have to access the fluid motion factor. You have to have the brain physiology become silent. Just like, I mean, it's just such a perfect example of what happened in the back nine of the Masters, where Jordan Spieth, he got a little quick at the top. He could not find the slot on the way down. Okay, he couldn't make the transition from the top of the swing coming down, so he started blocking the ball. That was all she wrote. That's it. Do you think he blocked any balls on the driving range before he started on Sunday? It's highly doubtful.
No, probably not. Yeah.
It's
do you think in his
doubtful.
Case,
okay.
right? Do you think in his case, is there a way to recover? You know, once that sort of you go down that slippery slope, is there a way to get back into, you know, that zone, if you will, once you've sort of broken it? Is there a way? Is there a technique that a player could do once they've sort of broken the chain?
It's called my program.
Okay.
Absolutely. You can reset the clock. The whole thing is anyone's going to make bad golf shots out there. I don't care who it is.
Sure.
Nicklaus. I saw Nicklaus pop a three-wood on TV one day, you know, maybe 15, 20 years ago. It's the ability to reset the clock on the fly so that one shot doesn't turn into two shots, three shots, the whole, one or two holes, there's a tournament. But what happens, here's the thing, Ted, okay? What's the reset mechanism that these guys use? Well, guess what? They grew up with video analysis, with TrackMan, with you know, Michael Breed on the Golf Channel, on all
yep.
these technical. So I really like Michael Breed. All these technical things. So what do they start defaulting? Well, something's wrong with the swing. Okay. Now, don't
yep.
you think that Jordan Spieth was trying to correct that on the back nine? How many block shot? How many
sure.
block drives did he hit? He couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Because when you go to the byproduct, it's not to say you can't do it, but you're giving yourself a very distinct disadvantage by going to the swing without understanding why the swing broke down in the first place. Remember, once
right.
you have muscle memory, you can't lose it. That's why you don't ride a bike for 10 years. You get on a bike, no one has to teach you how to ride a bike again. Now, in my book, okay, which I'm going to send you a copy, Ted. it's
okay.
It's fascinating to read.
That was going to be my last and final question.
No, you get it. You get a free copy. Don't worry, okay? In my book, I talk about what if there was this mythical tournament where a guy hits a tee shot, and if he doesn't like it, he can turn around 100 degrees, 180 degrees, tee it up, and hit it into the parking lot. Do you think that he would really ever miss that shot into the parking lot? Probably not. There's no pressure. There's not, you know, he's able to access what he already owns. So it's not that Jordan Spieth's swing broke down, even though, you know, they're doing video analysis in the round and he's, you know, he's not making the transition at the top. Well, here's the million-dollar question. Why wasn't he not making the transition at the top? He wasn't accessing the fluid motion factor. The brain physiology was not operating the way it was supposed to operate. So there was a roadblock, like a traffic jam, to get to his muscle memory. And when there's a roadblock and you can't access the muscle memory in your basal ganglia, then what happens is the bulk of your core muscles start to dominate the swing, and that's what happened to him.
Do you think what happens to a lot of we'll stick on players here. Do you think what happens to a lot of these guys is obviously it's their ability to handle tough situations, but, you know, let's say they're in that zone and suddenly they hit, you know, one or two bad shots that sort of, if you will, and this might be a simple way of putting it, but kind of jolts them or shocks them out of that zone. Do you think that what essentially happens now because they're sort of, you know, let's say as an example, you know, Jordan, again, you know, he's playing along fine in the front nine. All of a sudden something happens that sort of takes him out of that moment, if you will.
Yeah, one shot.
Yeah, and he's not able to recover.
It was his second shot on nine or something. Right.
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 So we know what happens, what takes him out of that. Essentially what's happening at that point is suddenly the mind's taking over. What did I do back here or what happened here? And suddenly the
right.
analytical side of the brain starts to take over, and essentially this is what you're saying is,
right.
is happening to a lot of these guys, and
not
what they need to do is get back.
Most
okay. Okay. So how
and
do they,
the great
what
one,
do they
here's
do?
The thing, the great one,
go
what
ahead.
Do they do? They go through my
yeah.
program. Okay. Here's the thing, Ted. Here's the thing, okay? This is not my program, in a way. This is nature's program. There's only one way
right.
to produce fluid motion. Okay, Stephen Yellen didn't come up with this, okay, now this is Stephen Yellen's take on how to produce fluid motion. No. You sit down with any neuroscientist and say, yeah, the signal has to bypass the prefrontal cortex. It has to go to the motor system, and then the cerebellum kicks in. The cerebellum tracks where the body is, where it has to be in a split second to execute a motion, and then it has the ability to self-correct a swing, so in case you're not exactly where you have to be at the top of your swing, the cerebellum can redirect the club on the way back so that a mediocre swing, you still have solid impact and square up the club at impact. This is the genius of the cerebellum. Everyone has had that experience. So this
right.
is not okay, this is, well, here's Stephen Yellen, you know, and he's talking, and, you know, this is nature. This is
right.
just nature. And what happens, the great ones, this is why Nicklaus said, you know what, the Masters really starts on the back nine on Sunday. Okay, everyone has heard that quote. And he
yep.
knows, he knew, okay, that 90% of the field are going to fold when they're under that pressure. So he only had to worry about, you know, a player or a Palmer or Watson or, you know, or whatever guys, you know, he played with. He knew that the other guys, I don't have to worry about those guys. They're going to self-destruct. Why are they going to self-destruct? Well, they're not going to be able to access what they already own, a Weisskopf or how many majors should Tom Weisskopf should have won, okay? Is that what happens is that in pressure situations, they – or Steve Elkington, how perfect was that swing? Is in pressure situations, in pressure situations, it's only one thing that separates them. It's not the swing, Ted. You can't tell me that Nicklaus had with a flying right elbow, okay, and coming off the ground with his right foot or whatever. You can't tell me, or his left foot. You can't tell me that he had a picture perfect swing. No, but he knew he would always have the secret weapon, and that is timing. He always knew his timing was going to be there, which means he was going to be able to access the fluid motion factor.
Right, and you look at, especially, if, I mean, today's golf professional is much different than it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But you look at guys like, you know, I've said this many times, Lee Trevino. I mean, Lee Trevino was a good example. I mean, he had a, by today's standards, you know, he had a horrible-looking swing. But he was able to, you know, exactly, and he just did not have, and there was a lot of players of that era that didn't have, you know, what we would classify as a robotic swing. And I mean, you look at players like Nick Faldo, who, of course, worked with, for a number of years, worked with David Ledbetter. I mean, Nick Faldo, you know, built, again, really one of the first sort of what I would call the robotic swings of that generation. And, of course, Steve Elkington, of course, was that way too, but very analytical and that. But I guarantee you that when he was going through those tournaments that he won successfully at the Masters a number of times and of course, the British Open, that, again, if you were to pose that question that you posed to me earlier, if you asked him what he was, you know, feeling and thinking at that time, he probably couldn't tell you.
Right, right. And I tell you, you know, there's different levels, and I'll tell you the highest level, okay? A guy like Nicklaus, this is a very interesting situation, okay? Because David has had extensive conversations with Jack, and David has relayed this information to me. And he said that, you know, Nicklaus, and again, this is going to go a little bit against what we were talking about, but I'll explain how it works. Right. Jack would have four or five swing thoughts during a swing, okay?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Four or five. That's a lot. Now, why didn't that shut down the fluid motion factor? Because you think that his intellect, his prefrontal cortex, was engaged. But it's not what you're thinking. It's how you're thinking. It's how softly you're generating the intention to have a swing thought. If the swing thought is a very loud kind of thought, where it's on the surface level of the mind, it shuts down the fluid motion factor in a nanosecond. If the swing thought or swing thoughts are generated from a very soft, quiet level, it's not going to cause an individual golfer problems in accessing what they already own, accessing the muscle memory and the basal ganglia. But to be able to think softly, have four or five swing thoughts on the back nine of Augusta, that takes a certain genius athlete, and there's not too many of them. But of course, Jack Nicklaus was one of them. Right.
Now, is this why then sometimes swing thoughts work and sometimes they don't?
100%. Okay. I have a whole chapter on that. Okay, it's called Weekly Drawings. What? You know, I worked with David Ogren for a while. David Ogren, who won on the PGA Tour, had 35 top 10. Pretty solid career. He loves this program. He's posting on Facebook all the time about this program. He teaches it to his students. He said, you know, I had a new swing thought every week or every 2 weeks max for 18 years. Why?
Right.
Why? Why would you want to have a new swing thought? Because what happens is that you have a swing thought that starts working. Oh, yeah, okay, you know, keep the left elbow tucked in. Let's say that's a swing thought, all right?
Yep.
And you're striking the ball really pure. You're striking the ball really pure. And then you have the same swing thought the next week, and all of a sudden, you know what? You're blocking it. You're not finishing the swing. You're not, you know, you're leaving the club face open. What happens is the reason why the swing thought stops working is because it was generated from a very surface level of the mind, which woke up
right.
the prefrontal cortex, which shut down the whole mechanics of transformation.
Right.
So there's nothing wrong. When I work with players, and I work with a lot of good players, I never tell them what to think. I don't care if they have swing thoughts. Now, what happens is eventually the swing thoughts, they have less and less because they realize they don't need it. But I don't care what you're thinking, Mr., you know, Mini Tour Hooter golfer or NGA or West Coast Florida Tour golfer or LPGA golfer. Think whatever you want because it's not what you're thinking. It's how you're thinking. And this is why pros on the highest level, they're always changing swing thoughts. It's kind of ludicrous kind of thing, you know? They're searching for the Holy Grail, and the Holy
yeah.
Grail is already there.
Well, let's talk a little bit. Let's take one of the tour players, of course, somebody very prominent that we've all come to watch in the last decade or so. Of course, I'm talking about Tiger Woods. What do you think, in your opinion, happened? Talk about first, because you mentioned earlier about how Tiger in his prime, he was sort of in that zone, and obviously we've seen what's happened in the last few years. Not that he hasn't won tournaments, but there's definitely a difference from Tiger of old to Tiger of new. So what in your estimation do you think has happened to Tiger, and what would you suggest, if you will, that a course that he would need to take from this point on?
Tiger lost his silence. He lost his ability to have that silence in his mind. And I'll tell you a perfect example of this was Tiger's year in 2013. He won five times on tour. Really,
yep.
You know, that's a career for most guys. He goes to Bay Hill, and he goes through this, I think it's 2 years ago, he goes through the field like a hot knife through butter. I mean, oh, Tiger's back.
Yep.
He's just playing fantastic. He's back.
Right.
3 weeks later, he tees it up at Augusta. He can't even find the fairway. He's all over
yeah,
the place.
Yeah, I remember that.
Now, do you think in 3 weeks Tiger lost his swing? It's
no,
ludicrous,
of course not.
Okay? It's ridiculous. No. What happened at Bay Hill, he, you know, maybe it was 71 going to 72 wins, okay? Well, after a while, who's counting anymore? Whether it's 70 or 71, does that really matter? But
right.
He goes to Augusta, he tees it up. Now he's 14 chasing 18.
Yep.
He's got 14 majors. He's chasing Jack at 18. So all his intentions were generated from a surface level. So, of course, the swing's going to break down. Do you think the swing controls the swing? You think the muscles control the muscles? Of course not. It's ludicrous. It's the brain physiology.
Yep.
So his brain physiology got very noisy because, after all, I'm trying to put myself in the history books. I better focus more, concentrate more, be more determined. Well, guess what? That's not how you access the fluid motion factor, Tiger. You access the
right.
fluid motion factor, you access it that you did so successfully for 15, 18 years, whatever, through silence. And what has happened to Tiger, we don't have to go into the details, okay, he
right.
lost his ability to access that silence. His swing didn't
yep.
break down. The quality of his silence broke down.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about it, you know, he's probably got a major interstate going through his head, you know, now compared to, you know, an old country road before where, you know, it was nice and quiet and you could just take a leisurely drive and you know, certainly he had his agendas and things at the time, but what you're saying certainly makes a lot of sense in Tiger's because it, you know, when you think about it, and this is not to knock, of course, Sean Foley. I think Sean Foley is a great instructor and has certainly helped Tiger with certain areas of his swing. But pre-Sean Foley, there was really nothing wrong with Tiger's swing. You know, it won multiple majors, it won many, many, many tournaments. But it's interesting that, you know, when Tiger sort of had his meltdown, if you will, and everything in his private life came out and things sort of changed, one of the first things that he did was went through a whole myriad of swing changes.
He was searching for gold in the wrong place, okay?
Right.
He was searching for gold in
It's like you said earlier. He basically went and instead of looking in the right area, he was looking at the end result, and really there was nothing wrong with his.
He went after the byproduct. Okay, now he success, which is the swing, changing the swing. He successfully did this between Butch Harmon and Hank Haney, right? So if I did it between when I went from Butch Harmon to Hank Haney. Well, why can't I do it when I go from Hank Haney to Sean Foley? Well, it's a little different situation now, Tiger, okay? The situation is that his nervous system was a little bit cruder. He didn't have access to that level of silence. And again, we don't have to talk about the details, okay? Is that it wasn't a nimble, supple, liquid kind of nervous system in his brain. And then he tries to do – and now Sean Foley is very technical, extremely technical.
Sure.
You know, we're talking about a millimeter here, a millimeter there. Well, guess what? How do you transform intention and execution? Fluid motion factor. Well, how do you access fluid motion factor? Quality of silence. Tiger didn't have that ability to have that access that quality of silence. Therefore, he could not be the precision monster that he was before so successfully. End of story. Back, Augusta. Three putts, all, same thing on the putting. It's no different on the putting green. His hands are, he doesn't have that softness anymore. He can't control the speed the way he used to control the speed. Controlling the speed is all about the softness of the hands. What controls the softness of the hands is the cerebellum. The cerebellum controls the softness of the hands. If the fluid motion factor is not accessed, brain physiology is not working correctly, then you don't have – you're fighting to see what kind of pressure and everything you have on your hands. And, again, two words, Las Vegas.
Yeah. Stephen, it reminds me really, Tiger's situation, even though the circumstances are entirely different, it reminds me very similar to what happened, I guess this would be back in the probably mid-'80s if I got my time frame, but to Greg Norman. We all remember Greg Norman being a phenomenal player, great ball striker, but he would get to a certain point and, when he started struggling in some of the majors and it was almost like a domino effect, and yet he would go out and win another tournament somewhere else. But when that, those majors would come back, it was almost like he had that monkey on his back. And, he just like you were saying a few moments ago about Tiger, he won five tournaments, the previous year, but then when he teed it up at Bay Hill, and then when he teed it up at Augusta National a few weeks later, he couldn't find the fairway. Do you think the same thing essentially, again, different circumstances, but the same thing essentially happened that's happening to Tiger happened to Greg Norman?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Greg Norman should have won 7 to 10 majors. Okay? Where did he win, 2?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
With his game. So what happened, is that key shots. Remember that shot when Faldo shot a 66 and won the Masters? He was Greg Norman was on 9, and he hit his approach shot short and ran down the green, okay? And everyone's, and that was the beginning of the end. I saw that on TV last. Oh, my goodness, look what's happening here.
Yeah.
Is that what happens, and you remember what I'm talking about, right? What happens, the same thing happened to Jordan Spieth, I think. What happens is that there's one turning point. There's just one turning point. And what happens, the turning point is traumatic and dramatic as far as accessing the muscle memory. So what happens is it becomes a permanent roadblock, more or less, to access what you already own. So all of a sudden, the swing breaks down. Peter Costas puts it on the Minolta Biz Hub, whatever.
Yep.
Oh, he's coming over the top. He's doing this. Well, Peter asked the question, why is he doing this now versus why he didn't do it on the first five holes?
Yep.
It's the brain physiology. It's not the muscles. Muscles are just the byproduct of the operation of how the brain physiology works. So this is what happens to guys who have tremendous talent. I mean, can you compare Lee Trevino's golf swing to Greg Norman's golf swing?
No, of course not.
It's, of course not, okay? But Lee Trevino bless his soul. I hope one day to meet him. He must be a great guy. He had access to that silence, okay? Now, I'm going to tell you an interesting story. I'm going to tell you a very interesting story. There was a guy by the name of Lee Jansen, okay?
Yep.
You've heard Lee won.
Oh, yeah.
Lee won 8 tournaments. He won 2 U.S. Opens, and he won a Players' Championship. And this is all early in his career. Now, Lee was a classic flipper of the club. He got it stuck, and he had to flip it to get it square at impact, okay? But, of course, he's a two-time U.S. Open Players Champion, 8-time winner on tour, flipper of the club, right?
Yep, right.
Okay. Would you take that career right now, Ted?
Oh, heck yeah.
So what happened is a very well-known teaching professional got in his head. I won't mention any names. He said, look, Lee, I know you're a flipper. You know you're a flipper. Let's go in there and let's change your swing so you stop flipping, because then you have a better chance of consistently getting that club back to square at impact and less chance of the swing breaking down. Well, Lee bit the bullet in 1998 after he won the U.S. Open. That was the end of his career.
Yeah.
And the reason why it was the end of his career is that even though mechanically, from a video analysis and from a mechanical standpoint, his swing did not look pretty, okay? And certainly you wouldn't want to teach someone how to swing like that, but he had access to the fluid motion factor. So the body, the cerebellum, would self-correct, so he would flip it just in the right amount of time to get that club back to square at impact, and as soon as he went in and started to do surgery on his club, he lost that, the cerebellum shut down. So he had to make a picture-perfect swing. He had to make a picture-perfect swing because there was no correcting mechanism in the brain physiology to make those self-corrections, to make the body liquid. That was the end of his career. That was it. He was done.
Yeah, and you know, the same thing could be not to say that his career has ended, but the same could be said for Jim Furyk. I mean, if you look at Jim Furyk, same thing. He's got the loop and everything else going on there, and I'm sure there's probably 100 instructors out there that would love to pick apart his swing and rebuild it, and that would be the worst thing you could do for someone like Jim Furyk. You know, it often reminds me of a player, and he still does a little bit of announcing. I think he did for NBC for a while. I don't see him that much anymore, but it reminds me of another well-accomplished player, but had a very early, ending to it, if you will, is Ian Baker Finch. I mean, you look at Ian Baker Finch, if you go back and look at early video of him, he was a phenomenal ball striker. And, I mean, the sad part of it was, it was like you were watching him one week, and the next week, my career's over. And,
Okay. Right. I know that I got the story on Ian Baker Finch because I have a friend who's one of his dear friends.
Right.
Ian Baker Finch went in there to try to hit the ball farther. Okay? He was not a long hitter. And once you do that, you are on very, very shaky grounds because you're leaving the territory that made you very, very good to some unknown woman. That it's a mail order bride. You don't know what you're going to get. Okay,
yeah.
And they lost. This is what happens all the time, Ted. Okay,
yeah.
Is that everyone is working on their swing. I'll tell you another story. This story was told to me by Ric Flair. You ever hear the name Ric Flair?
Yep.
Ric Flair won twice on PGA Tour.
Mm-hmm.
As he likes to say, he played 400 tournaments. He was 2 for 400. Okay? Now, when Ric Flair graduated college, he was the number 2 college golfer in the country behind Lanny Watkins. And he won 15, 20 big tournaments in his 4 years at Brigham Young. And he was a sure bet to be the next superstar. Well, he won twice.
Yep.
And that's not a superstar. And he never won a major. And Rick told me this story. He said, Stephen, when I graduated college, if I did not change one thing in my swing, I would have won 15 times on tour and competed in multiple majors. But because I was going from a collegiate career to a professional career, I thought I had to up the ante in my swing and perfect it, and I went sideways for 20 years. End of story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so true. And there's a thousand players in the history of the game that we could probably go down a long list. But, Stephen, it's hard to believe, but the hour went by so quick, and we've just got a moment or two here, so I want to give you an opportunity to let the listeners know where they can get their hot little hands on a book when it comes out again.
They should want
and
to get the,
also,
they should be running to my website right now.
Yep.
Okay,
read
so
it out,
my website.
Read it out to them, Stephen.
Okay, here we go. My website is fluidmotiongolf.com. One word, fluidmotiongolf.com. And on the website, there's a lot of information about what programs I offer. I offer a certification program for coaches. It's an online program. The certification program can also be used for players. I have a number of really talented professional players, mini tour players, and a little bit more than mini tour players, have taken the online course, and it's very effective. And of course, I teach the program. I'm sort of with my parents in Iowa right now, just chilling a little bit because Florida is a little warm in the summer. But I teach the program at David Ledbetter's World Headquarters at Champions Gate in Orlando. So.
Right.
You have a few ways to go. You can always come down to Orlando or just go online. And the book, just send me an email if you want to be on the list when the book comes out. But the book, Ted, is a real mind blower. And actually, I changed the name of the book a little bit. It's called The Fluid Motion Factor, Understanding the Source of Exceptional Golf.
Hmm. Well, I look forward to getting a copy when that gets done in print. It sounds very intriguing, very interesting, and I'm certainly excited to read through that in its entirety. And Stephen, I want to thank you for coming on. One of the things I enjoy doing with this program, I've said this a million times, is obviously we want to help people out there with their golf game and give them some great instruction. But when something like this comes along, I truly want to share this with the audience because it's not just for the average player out there to understand, but also a lot of coaches and teachers listen to the program as well, and I want them to be aware of what's available out there and to make them aware of what you're doing. So I appreciate you coming on and sharing that with my audience tonight.
I had a great time, Ted. I hope I was a good guest here.
Yeah, you were fantastic, and you're welcome to come back anytime. Stephen, it was a pleasure, and I will send you an email with my address and that. I'm looking forward to getting a copy, and I want to wish you much success with this book. I think it's going to be a number one seller for sure, especially through the golf industry. I think it's a great thing, and especially having somebody as accomplished as David Ledbetter working with you as well with the program. I think that's kudos to you for that. David
wrote a fantastic introduction to the book. You'll see it when you read it. So.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very honored and excited to be associated with David.
Yeah, David's a great guy, and certainly I know if he's putting his stamp of approval on there, I know it's first class. But, Stephen, thank you very much for coming on and reaching out to me and coming on the program, and I will certainly be more than happy to have you back on the program anytime you wish. And let me know.
We have to do it again. I had a great time, Ted.
Yeah. Yeah, let me know exactly when the book email me when the book officially hits the doors, if you will, and I will make sure that I plug it here on the show for you. All right.
I really appreciate that. That's very kind of you, Ted.
Not a problem. Have a great evening and happy Fourth to you and your family.
Thank you so much, Ted. Same to you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Good night. Okay, that was Stephen Yellen, author of The Fluid Motion Factor. Sounds like a great book, and it's going to be available on his website coming shortly, and that's my lovely assistant reminding me that the show is about to close off here in a few moments. You can get that book will be available in a few weeks. I think, believe he said 3 to 4 weeks. Fluidmotiongolf.com. Make sure you check out Stephen's book. And also, if you want to take the certification course, you can also find out information on there as well at fluidmotiongolf.com. I want to thank again my special guests on the panel tonight, Gary Occhino, Michael Wheeler, and Brad Redding, and of course, my special guest, Stephen Yellen, author of The Fluid Motion Factor. Thanks, guys, for stopping by Golf Talk Live, and thank you to all of the listeners worldwide that tune in faithfully every week to Golf Talk Live. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure. Pleasure and enjoyment having a number of highly talented coaches, teach professionals, and of course authors stopping by the program, participation and guest appearances that have helped make Golf Talk Live a first-class show. So I want to give a special thank you out to all of them, of course, and to all of you for tuning in. Thank you to also some of the sponsors and supporters of the program, Mr. Jonathan Laird of South Coast Golf Guide, Ms. Meredith Kirk of Meredith Kirk Golf and Menless Golf Myrtle Beach Magazine, and, of course, the 2014 Mrs. South Carolina. And she's, in about a month's time, or a little less than a month's time now, she's going to be going for the Mrs. America pageant. She's going to be entered in that as well. So good luck, Meredith, on that. Thank you for your continued support. And Nikki and Tiffany Litherland, of course, for your help spreading the word about the show. Mr. Bernie Pinder from Ontic Golf, a great line of custom-made putters. Definitely check out Bernie's website, onticgolf.com. And, of course, my good buddy over in Ireland, Mr. Peter Doyle of Doyle Golf Solutions. Thank you, Peter, again, for your continued support. Don't forget, every Tuesday on blogtalkradio.com, I also have another program that I co-host with LPGA professional Cindy Miller. That's on Tuesday mornings at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. That's Eastern Time, not Central. That's 9 a.m. in the mornings at blogtalkradio.com/womenofgolf. And that's something for you ladies. And every Thursday night, don't forget to join me right here on Golf Talk Live at 6 p.m. That's Central Time, or 7 p.m. Eastern Time for you on the East Coast. And don't forget to join me for my regular program Thursday evenings on Golf Talk Live. Thank you, everybody. Have a great holiday. Happy 4th of July to all of my American friends. God bless everybody and have a great weekend. Be safe out there, and I will see you next week on Golf Talk Live.